Next up on This Week in Law, we've got Katie Fortney. She's the Copyright Management Officer for the California Digital Library, a copyright expert. We're going to talk about, guess what, copyright. Grab your popcorn because there's a new way to pirate. Should kids be banned from using handholds? Who owns selfies and life logging photos? And much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWIL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, recorded March 14th, 2014. Slugs in the popcorn. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. I'm so excited you're here today. We've got a great guest, and that's Katie Fortney from the California Digital Library. Katie, so great to have you on the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Very excited to chat with you. Katie has a law background and a library background. You've worked in the UC system for some time. Maybe you should tell us first and foremost here at the top of the show about California Digital Library and what exactly that is. I'm familiar with it since I kind of grew up in the UC system, but we get folks listening from all over the country and all over the world. So can you fill us in on what's going on with the California Digital Library?
All kinds of stuff. So there are 10 UC campuses, and each of them has their own library, but then CDL, California Digital Library, is a central unit that does things for all the campuses and all the folks there. So they do data stuff, data management plan tools, and they do consortial licensing to get better deals on content for everybody. They run the institutional repository where people can publish journals or post their articles. And now we're supporting the new UC open access policy.
Cool. Well, we want to hear more about that. But first, we want to introduce Evan Brown, my co-host. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Happy Pi Day. How's it going?
Happy Pi Day. So excited.
Yes, there how are you celebrating? Are you doing anything good?
I'm simply reveling in the fact that there are more pie pictures than cat pictures on the internet. And it's just, yeah. I think, only today that that ever happens.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
If we put a cat coming out of a pie, maybe, you know, our heads would explode.
Yes, the internet would certainly explode if that happened.
Exactly. Yes. Well, let's get to it. Lots of fun stuff to talk about. Good goings on all kinds of copyright fronts. Let's start out with some that are more entertainment focused. All right. So there's a brand new way to pirate movies, touted as perhaps the most effective and pleasurable way. Gosh, can I say that word? Pleasurable way to pirate movies because it's just so darn easy and convenient. Got some ink this week, something called Popcorn Time. And they are sort of it sounds like a loosely joined group of like-minded folks who have developed this non-money-making app, a piece of software that you can download to your Mac or PC or Linux or various other platforms that it runs on. And what it does is it goes out and finds torrents for you, basically aggregates a whole bunch of stuff that you would need to do a lot of hard work on your own that, you know, your Joe Public kind of person might not go to such hard work. But using this application, it brings it all together very nicely. It makes what has been touted in headlines as the Netflix for pirates. It just makes it very easy to browse torrents and then play what you can find in their application. And the reason that I bring up, you know, who's doing this and whether they're charging for it is that this seems to be their legal cover. Aside from the fact that they're not hosting anything on their own, they're simply aggregating stuff that if you wanted to go through a bunch of work and do it yourself, you could. And they're not charging money. They're not pointing people towards particular content that might be infringing versus other content that's not infringing. What else in the case law do they seem to be distinguished from? I'm sure there's more, but also there's a big old disclaimer when you first download and run the application that says, look, possibly you're going to be seeing some copyrighted movies using our application. It could be illegal for you to view those movies depending on your country, et cetera. And we accept no responsibility, et cetera, for you doing that. So be aware and, you know, click here to acknowledge. So, Evan, you brought this to my attention. Do you have anything to add to how I've just teed this up?
No, I mean, that's a pretty accurate description of it. I think there's another little sort of story that has unfolded in the last couple of days is, you know, this was originally stored on Mega, Kim.com's newer service, and it was pulled down, and I think it's back up. So there's sort of a little bit of that drama as to, you know, what somebody like Kim.com would even think of this service. I don't know that there's anything to be read from that. But, you know, clearly when we think about this in terms of the copyright issues that arise, I think naturally we would think of the big, you know, the Mount Rushmore of P2P P2P platform litigation. You know, of course, going all the way back, you know, the 13 years, however many, to Napster, and then of course the granddaddy of them all, the Grokster decision. You know, what is the liability here? What is the risk of secondary liability for a provider of this service? And so the things that you're describing, Denise, the things that they've done, yeah, particularly the disclaimer, is probably the most obvious one. Ways of separating, distinguishing this service and the way that it's provided from Grokster, for example, and having those indicators that its providers are inducing the users to actually commit direct copyright infringement. So, you know, it's just interesting here how well polished it is, what a nice user interface it is, how easy it makes this whole process, which does require more than a modicum of technical ability to actually receive and continue to distribute files by BitTorrent like this. So it reminds me a little bit of, you know, the world coming to a place where you, at least in certain states and certain environs of the United States, you can go to, like, you know, a well-lit, safe retail establishment to buy marijuana. Used to be things that you'd have to do watching, you know, over your shoulder and always, you know, wondering who's, you know, what people are going to think of you. Here it's just this nice environment for something that, you know, at its core is something that people still debate about whether it should be done. I guess we'll leave it that way.
Right. Well, I don't know that people can get too comfortable that they're in as good legal shape as they would be buying recreational marijuana in Colorado, for example, because certainly what they're doing could still put the individual users in the legal gun sites. You know, the MPAA has backed off on those lawsuits, but if something like this really took hold, there's no guarantee that we wouldn't see, you know, rising from the fires, the phoenix of litigation against individual users. Katie, what do you think of this?
I think it looks really sweet. I know a lot of people who don't want to dig into using BitTorrent and find their own files, and that scares them a little bit. But something that's shiny and looks like Netflix, I think they're not going to be super concerned about the threat of litigation. People are willing to take their chances.
So from the library standpoint, I think it's kind of interesting when something like this comes along because people come in oftentimes to university libraries just to use the computers or one step removed, use the Wi-Fi and perhaps fire up Popcorn Time and kick back in a big comfy chair and hang out for a bit. Is this something that would be on your radar as the copyright manager, or is that you're more concerned with the collections themselves?
I wouldn't be concerned about that. Just for us providing the internet access for it, we would just wait around for someone to send us notices that they would do under the law and do that. But it's not going to be a problem on library machines, even though people walk in and use them, because you're pretty limited on what you can download there. And those get scrubbed and refreshed daily.
All right. So I got a pretty funny email that at first I thought was from the developers of Popcorn Time after all these stories broke. But no, on further and deeper examination, it's from somebody called XBMC Hub. And they are very up in arms, and they sent out this blast email, it looks like, to the tech media in general, because they want people to know that they've been doing this for a long time, darn it. And if somebody is the Netflix of piracy, it's not Popcorn Time, it's them. And so they're really irked that they did not get all the publicity. So,
right. What do you have to do these days to violate copyright laws and get some attention?
Right.
You know, it's just like, yeah, it's all, it all just blends in. So
that's right.
How did you get that email? I guess I'm not part of the official tech media.
I don't.
That makes me feel.
Goodness knows. And they actually, it's a dear sir or madam email. So it's not directed to any particular person. And it takes the approach that you have already written about this product and that you should have included us. So I haven't written about anything. We're chatting about it today, and we are including you, XBMC Hub. And we'd be happy to tell folks about any other products like this that are doing what this does, although we certainly wouldn't encourage you to use such products in an infringing way. Evan, what do you think the BitTorrent folks who have been distancing themselves from anything to do with copyright infringement, what do you think they think about this?
You're talking about BitTorrent as a commercial entity rather than the technology
yes.
underlying it, right? Yeah. So, well, I mean, it's just another iteration of the same sort of concern that they would have, you know, this technology that clearly lends itself well to uses that infringe copyright. You know, it's the same legal analysis, really. You know, what is the potential liability for the mode or the instrumentality by which the infringement can occur? And I really don't think fundamentally their concern should be any different than what a manufacturer of a VCR should have been after 1984 with the Sony Betamax decision. You know, it's just a tool. It's used, and you know there clearly are opportunities for it to be used. But other than you know, understanding those fundamental legal principles and where liability is going to end at one party and attach to the next one, it's just simply a branding and a public relations and a marketing issue. At this point, though, I don't know how public perception of just the word BitTorrent is going to ever be separated from the notion of the way BitTorrent is notoriously used. That just could be a semantic thing that never is, you know, those concepts may never be cleaved from one another. But, you know, I guess there are always opportunities to, you know, put forth a brand, modify the brand, make sure it's being put out there in the way that's most useful to the brand owner.
Okay, let's move on and talk about, if we weren't directly talking about Netflix, let's do it now. Because over at Wired, there's a piece, let me see who it's by here. Because I don't get it, and I need you to explain to me, perhaps. Marcus Wolfson wrote a piece saying that Netflix is getting burned by Comcast because Sony has made a deal with Comcast where the first season of House of Cards is going to be available in Comcast's Xfinity store. And Marcus is trying to tee this up as something that is bad for Netflix, or is, you know, oh, you know, this is just another way that the cable companies are coming after Netflix. If it's not net neutrality, then it's this. And I don't get it. I would think that Netflix would be perfectly happy to have the widest possible distribution of this show, which shows people, you know, how much we don't really need our conventional Hollywood studio structure and distribution to get good programming. Do you get this at all, Evan?
I get how it can be a provocative way of introducing the topic and get page views to the Wired piece and all that stuff. And, you know, that it is what it is. And it's that, of course, is ripe for being exploited in that way because of the dealings we've seen between Netflix and Comcast and the problems that we discussed. Was it just last week or has it been a couple weeks now when we talked about the Comcast, the deal, the whole peering arrangements and all of that mm-hmm. stuff. So, yeah. Of course, the environment is ready for it to be cast in that way. So it wouldn't be nearly as intriguing if it was just saying, well, this is just an ordinary run-of-the-mill. And that's actually what Marcus's piece said, you know, kind of in the larger scheme of things, the way these things worked with reruns being broadcast, it's really not that big of a deal. He seems to say that it's something particularly because of the parties here. So, you know, there's like you, I'm having a hard time seeing what the big deal is. When I first, you know, started reading the headlines about this and just sort of, you know, how, I don't know if this is like you, but for the first few hours, you know, sometimes on your Twitter stream, you just get new developments by osmosis as you're seeing people tweet about them. I thought that, you know, Comcast had stolen it outright, like, you know, for to have the first rights, you know, for all the new episodes and stuff like that. Like it was totally moving from Netflix over to Comcast. I'm like, yeah, that'd be a big deal. And that truly would be a burn. But we're talking about past seasons here. And you're being very good, I think, about bringing that up, Denise. It's sort of the whole ethos we have, like, well, you know, isn't piracy a good thing? Because the wider the distribution, the more interest you're going to generate. There's, you know, at a certain level, there's that comparison to be made here. I think you said, you know, why wouldn't Netflix want it as widely distributed as possible? So,
right, I'm with you. But it's
interesting, but not a huge deal.
It's not like this isn't an authorized distribution. It's not like,
of course, yeah,
it's something that Netflix didn't, you know, there's no lawsuit against Comcast in the works over this or against Sony. There are agreements in place that make all of this happen just fine. And it just seems like, you know, I don't know if windowing is the right term when things are released at different times in different media. But it just seems like, you know, reverse windowing from Netflix out to wherever it's going to be distributed. Katie, do you have any different take on this?
Nope, I'm with you. It seems like an odd thing to make a big deal out of. I mean, people are only going to be able to get it contemporaneously through Netflix. They can wait and get it on cable, just like now they can wait and get Breaking Bad or Mad Men on Netflix. So yeah, it seemed kind of like clickbait there.
Yeah. All right. Well, now that we've given it even more play.
Right. Everybody check your system for malware, because that's what it was all about, probably. So yes. Go to the page. Never mind.
Well, one of the things I enjoyed clicking through in Katie's Twitter stream this week as we were getting ready for the show was this hysterical primer, really, over at TMZ, I wonder who authored this. Oh, it just says TMZ staff. So we don't know what their legal background was in particular, but they go into the copyright ramifications of the famous Oscar selfie and point out that Ellen doesn't own the picture, even though it was her camera. Bradley Cooper does because he was the photographer. So this is something that's just a funny wrinkle and something that people, you know, it's not very intuitive for folks, is it, Katie?
No, when I talk to students and, you know, normal people who are not lawyers, that's something that always surprises folks. But you don't expect to get your copyright education from TMZ. But you never know.
Exactly. Sometimes you do. I'm spacing on the guy's name now, the guy who is Mr. TMZ, who's their overlord, who sits at the front of the room and chats with everyone when you watch their show.
You're not going to hear it from me because I would never betray that's the cultural layer that I exist in. So, you know, I don't know. TM what, you know?
Yeah. Anyway, Harvey Levin, yes. So he's, thank you, Spring Rubber 8 in IRC. Harvey Levin, he's a lawyer. You often get some interesting legal wrinkles pointed out either by Harvey or others at TMZ. Let's see. it gets interesting, I suppose, because this is a very well-known photo. I mean, it's everywhere, right? It's being used commercially everywhere.
Nobody involved with the photo is interested in restricting its use. So it doesn't seem like any kind of litigation is likely. They want you to keep distributing it, keep copying it as much as you can.
Right. But if let's go all innocence of Muslims on this and decide that someone has just it was someone, maybe it's Kevin Spacey in the back there, has decided, nope, not my gig. I never agreed to this. I'm going to put my foot down and go after all these sites that are reprinting this photo. Katie, do you think he'd have any basis for it?
Well, depends who's reprinting it. If they're reporting on the news, the fact that it's the most widely retweeted photo ever, no. But if they crop it down and try to imply that Kevin Spacey is endorsing Samsung, sure, you could go there under certain state laws, right?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. What do you think, Kevin?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's an easy entree into rights of publicity there. I mean, the copyright issues are interesting. And I thought where you might be going when you said, let's get all innocence of Muslims on this, you know, like what do the participants in the photo, what did they have to do in terms of the actual creation of the photo? And I think, you know, I'm reminded of kind of the first case that really validated the notion that there's copyright protection in photographs in the first place. It was the Cerrone case. It was a photo of Oscar Wilde. And so there's some interesting vocabulary that comes from that case. This is from like the 1880s, perhaps. Am I getting my epochs, you know, and eras of literature correct there? You know, the whole idea of what the subject matter of the photograph may contribute to the copyrightability, the copyright status of that photograph. And really in the Cerrone case, they were talking more about the creative elements of setting up the lighting and all of that stuff. So I'm not really sure. Well, that's kind of freaky. That made me think there was something going on with the right hand.
He's peeking into the back.
What is that?
Well done, Victor.
It really creeped me out, to be honest. I have no idea what I was just talking about. No, something about contributing copy originality to a photograph, something like that.
There's original expression expressed in how they pose and hold their face for that half second.
Yes. And it just doesn't seem real plausible. I think we have a hard time constructing all of that, don't we? With where's Liza Minnelli when you need her? You know, the whole idea of, you know, it takes a little bit more than just appearing in a photograph to actually be, you know, what's, you know, to actually contribute something.
For those of you who may be listening to us audio only and have no idea, oh, now he's on my shoulder, the other shoulder. Kevin Spacey has been photobombing us for the last several minutes here as we've been chatting about the photo.
It has been really weird. This has been a really weird last few minutes. So anyway.
And he's gone. He's moved on. All right. Let's do the same. Let's take our cue from Mr. Spacey. And I did want to ask, though, as long as we're on this topic of permissions and selfies and just like the flourishing of photos and the flourishing of sharing of photos, you know, it's not like any of this is going to grind to a halt. It's going to get more and more rich and complex. And I think the whole act of getting permissions is going to get more important, and it better get more streamlined, because, you know, I don't know about you, Evan, but I am fairly regularly advising clients that, you know, about the permissions that they need to get as far as sharing videos and photos and stuff. And it's not an easy process, and it's not a process that people want to go through. You know, really, we've got to go to these 800 kids that we're working with and then their parents and get permissions. Do you see this situation improving anytime soon?
Well, I mean, the whole notion of the higher awareness we have about this because of the innocence of Muslim decision, and then, you know, the interest of this stuff because of, you know, Ellen's Oscar selfie. That takes it in the direction of making it even more convoluted and more complex, which is, I think, what you are suggesting. And you're right. People don't like having to deal with this stuff. It's kind of the same part of the brain that causes disdain over having to sign or being asked to sign or asking someone to sign a non-disclosure agreement. It's like, my lawyers are so hard to get along with. They make me do all this stuff. Don't we all hate lawyers? Let's make fun of lawyers. Let's tell lawyer jokes and talk about how bad they are and all that stuff. You know, it's that part that just plays into it, makes it more complicated and makes business harder to do and all of that stuff. But, you know, it's real. And I don't see a good way around it because these rights are important to the individual, whether they be rights of publicity, which is the general garden variety issue that you're dealing with in a, you know, getting a release for having somebody's kid appear in a video or something like that. And, you know, with these types of issues, again, the innocence of Muslims and the Ellen selfie, that sort of brings in copyright notions to it as well, which easily get sort of glossed over when we're talking about releases and stuff like that. So I don't see a real efficient solution to it other than just thoroughness and trying to be a good human being in your dealings with people when you're asking them to sign documents.
All right. Well, I'm not sure if we've ever made selfie an MCLE passphrase in the show, but now was it Webster's who made it word of the year? Let's make it our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you're listening to the show for continuing legal education credit or other professional credit, we put these phrases in case your oversight body needs proof that you've actually listened to or watched the show. So that'll be our first one. Let's move on to the Aereo case, which a little over a month from now will be argued before the Supreme Court. We've discussed it a lot on the show back and forth over the last years since it has been percolating around the courts of the country and before it arrived at the Supreme Court. Mike Masnick has an article over at TechDirt pointing out that this isn't just about how people can consume television and whether the little tiny antennas turn out to be legally okay or not. According to Mike, if the Supreme Court gets this, what he would consider wrong, it could have an astoundingly bad chilling effect on pretty much all cloud computing. And he goes on to explain in detail why he thinks that's the case. Evan, do you think he's gone too far here?
No, because, you know, if you have the Supreme Court saying something, that is a very firm stamp on that statement of the law. And, you know, that is the source from which you look for jurisprudence on these issues. And, you know, very seldomly do you get future factual scenarios that match up precisely with what the Supreme Court said. So you look to the Supreme Court to develop broad legal principles that address as many issues as really can. So if we did get a holding from the Supreme Court that said that it is a public performance to do what Aereo does, and, you know, it's not that difficult then to make leaps over analogically, factually to more, actually less technical, cumbersome applications of technology, e.g. cloud computing. And by that whole saying it that way, you know, kind of just a nod to the fact that Aereo actually is quite cumbersome and sort of weird technologically. You have each, you know, one antenna for each little individual. It's just like you got to do this crazy stuff to fit in with the constraints of the law. So the easier example factually is to just say, you know, something's stored on your cloud drive, on your service, you know, your service of choice, whether it be Amazon, Apple, Google, Dropbox, for crying out loud. You know, anytime you have a copyrighted work stored on that server and it's your copy that you perhaps lawfully obtained, or let's just assume you did lawfully obtain it in the first instance, if you're going to have it up there, your own personal copy, just like that, your own personal copy of the over-the-air broadcast that you have the right to lawfully obtain, if you're going to, you know, be out there streaming that to yourself wherever you are using your device, you know, that's not much of a leap to make analogically over from the factual instance in the Aereo case over to just the run-of-the-mill cloud computing, streaming content, you know, personal copy stuff. So I of course, think that that would be disastrous if that's the argument that started to be being made. It would certainly not foster innovation, but there's no reason to think that that's what, you know, the argument, the way that the arguments would go. So, you know, Mike, of course, is quick to make big, you know, very provocative arguments like this and really stir up issues like this. But I'm with him. I think that it could really be a it put us in a problematic situation if those arguments started to be made.
Katie, is it all about whether the court finds Aereo's system to be engaged in unauthorized public performances? And if it finds that way, are you concerned that the scenario that Evan just laid out, where you're, you know, simply storing something for your personal use and streaming it to yourself, that too would be swept into this public performance rubric?
Yeah, I don't see a way around that. And there's a lot of the amicus briefs that have been filed so far are saying that exact same thing. It's very broad. And I don't know that parade of horribles is going to be convincing to the court. They might just look at the law and say, well, maybe the transmit clause is stupid, but that's Congress's problem. We're just going to read it and they'll have to revise it.
Mm-hmm. It would be fun if they actually put that in the opinion. The transmit clause,
I paraphrase,
is stupid. Yeah. Yes. Or what do you think about Cablevision? Is it on the blocks as they go through and consider this case? The decision that allowed for the remote DVR.
Right. I don't know how you keep Cablevision and say what Aereo does is illegal without writing a very twisted, ridiculous legal opinion, which is not out of the question in this realm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, okay. So we have to wait a month. I don't know that we'll all be able to do that, but there's certainly a lot to think about as the court. We'll have to wait a month until it's argued, and then we'll have to figure out what the court's going to do after that. In the meantime, down under in Australia, Google has been making the case that piracy is not about people wanting to do nefarious things or break the law, but that it's an availability and pricing problem. This seems to be kind of a creaky ancient argument that Google is trotting out again. It's not any less correct for being old, but Evan, did you, aside from the fact that there's a very funny typo in this Torrent Freak piece that we have in our discussion points, what was that typo again?
Ant piracy.
So, ant piracy.
I don't know if the ants are pirates or if we're pirating the ants. I just don't get it. But yeah, I mean, this is the second week in a row where I'm just sort of questioning Google's motives in its policy pronouncements and in the arguments it's making. You know, last week I was talking about how Google argued in the Innocence of Muslims case that it was a ridiculous proposition under copyright law. I was saying, well, Google doesn't want to be troubled with the administrative burden of policing its systems in a way that's any more that requires any more of it than what it currently does. They'd probably like to have less involvement with the policing of copyrighted works on their system. So in this kind of situation here, you know, Google's interest is also in seeing that there are not strong regulations, laws, frameworks in place to combat piracy, because inevitably that's going to put more work, more burden on the intermediary. So there's a very good business reason, a very good non-copyright business reason for Google to take the position that it's taking here. And it also just happens to sound good. Oh, you know, we really should, instead of going after people individually and trying to get money from them because they broke the law, we should foster innovation. Doesn't that sound, you know, nice and fluffy? And who's going to disagree with that? And how are you not going to engender goodwill by saying something like that. So it's kind of there's a lot of bang for Google's buck in taking a position like that. And so, but that I'm by no means am saying that this isn't critically important, and I'm certainly mm-hmm. not saying that I disagree with what Google's saying. I just think we always got to be cautious about their motives of not just Google but anybody. When you know what are they really saying in these things here? And you know it's timely. That this sort of thing is coming up again because I heard rumblings just this morning, and by that it was the top story on the front page of Reddit this morning that mm-hmm. it was a misleading entry in Reddit that SOPA is back. That's mm-hmm. an overstatement, but there are starting to have discussions again in Congress. You know, it's that you know the internet blackout in January of 2012 didn't scare people or didn't scare the pro SOPA contingency away completely. They may have run into hiding for a little bit, but you know that whole notion, that whole spirit of really cracking down on piracy at a infrastructure level is still alive and well, and trying to raise its head at cocktail parties, at least in forms of congressional discussions. So you know that whole idea of what Google is promoting to the Australian government goes right in line with all of those concerns that we still need to be vigilant about. We've been given plenty of new stuff to worry about since January of 2012. Well, with Ed Snowden and everything else, and cybersecurity, we can't take our eyes off of these concerns as well as the government trying to just wreck the whole fabric and infrastructure of the internet for us.
Yeah, it just seems like, you know, you would think as we sat here in 2014 that a lot would have changed from the days of Napster. But it really seems like those two polarized positions, although they've come a little bit closer together, the rights holders versus, you know, the users who really want to have access to everything with as little friction as possible. It's not that they don't want to pay. They just want it to be reasonably priced and more than reasonably convenient. That, you know, although those sides are coming together a bit, they're still just duking it out as much as ever. We see Aereo with its tiny little antennas. We see Popcorn Time attempting to make BitTorrent user-friendly. And then we see, you know, moves to try and clamp down. And then we have on the other side of the coin here, folks like Google urging, look, you know, we've got to change policy and legislation to reflect that we can't have a lawsuit every time somebody comes up with a new way to infringe. Katie, do you see any kind of resolution to all of this? It certainly has been going on forever.
Yeah, it's going to keep going. Mm-hmm. I think as more services come out that work, and so like when Netflix enters a new market, what Norway saw their piracy rates drop something like 50%, and as more tools are built, but they are slow. Very tech-savvy friends of mine are still whining about how, you know, I tried to be good this week and actually pay for my content to support support where it's coming from, but now I can't watch it on the device I want to watch it on. So it's pricing, it's availability, and convenience. People want to watch what they want to watch when they want to watch it, and the business models are trying to catch up.
Right. All right. Well, I think we've pretty much exhausted our topics in the entertainment arena, although there's all kinds of crossover, of course, when you're talking about technology and copyright. Let's look specifically at what's been being discussed this week about Orphan Works and copyright. So Orphan Works is a huge problem Katie, why don't you first, for people who aren't, you know, lawyers or copyright scholars and may have no idea what we're talking about, describe what they are and why it's a problem.
So they're works that you either can't tell who the copyright owner is, or if you have an idea, you can't find them. We see it come up in libraries a lot for books where publishing houses have gone out of business, old photographs that libraries have in special collections with no identifying information. And if you want to preserve that stuff or help it find a new audience, there's nobody to pay because no matter how hard you look, you can't find them.
And so instead of being usable, these things wind up not being usable because folks are terrified that, as we've been discussing, copyright litigation against them is going to be the end result. And someone inevitably will come out of the woodwork and say, hey, you know, you thought that was an orphan work, but it's not. We have the rights and we'll take you through the convoluted documentation that shows that perhaps we do. So it's a huge chilling effect under the law on our cultural heritage. And so folks in Washington have been discussing this week. Katie, have they come to any solutions?
No, not even close. I really wish I could have been at those hearings. It sounds like it was an absolute zoo. You had library representatives there. You also had rights holder representatives there. And some of the folks that are really worried are, say, the photographer representatives, because it is very easy to disassociate a photograph from information about who took it. And also the Authors Guild rep was up in arms. And as the link that I think you retweeted of mine, they threatened libraries with lawsuits, which is unusual in a roundtable discussion to just say, well, if you sue this, and they said it very broadly, like not just, you know, libraries are very cautious. They're not looking to take their collections and put them online in a popcorn time kind of way for everybody to view. But they want to preserve things that they can't buy anymore. And the author's rep said, basically, you do that and we are going to sue you. And apparently people kind of looked around like, what did you just, and woke up and it came
up
again.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Yeah, exactly. Get the librarians rowdy. And said it again. And when questioned about it a third time, instead of acknowledging that maybe that's not the most productive way to work with libraries, said, well, it's worked before. So that's fun and scary.
Have they read the Google Books decision?
Yeah, perhaps not. And then somebody else, I think this was the photographer's rep, compared recent fair use decisions like Google Books, HathiTrust, Georgia State case, which was about e-reserves in a university library, compared those, the state of the law now with fair use, to Plessy versus Ferguson, which seems a little extreme.
It's better than the Boston Strangler, I guess.
At least more obscure. People have to go up, and if they're not, it's not right at the tip of their tongue, they have to go look up what was Plessy again.
Yeah, they get a civics lessons in pursuit, you know.
Right. Yeah, Google will help you out with that one.
Yeah, again. So I guess explain how this would play out. What exactly is it that someone like the California Digital Library wants to do in the way of preserving orphan works that has the Authors Guild all hopped up?
So there's HathiTrust, which a bunch of university library book collections have been scanned by Google. Google gave copies of the scans back to the libraries, which put them all in one big pile. And now everyone can search either at Hathi or at Google Books, the full text of all of these books. You can't go read them. You get displayed in snippets. But you can do things like preserve them. If your copy gets lost and you can't get a new copy, you can take advantage of the library exception and use your old digital copy. You can make them accessible to print disabled folks, also under the library exceptions. And the authors want none of that. Just, the state of things right now, because of the length of copyright term, is it is much easier to get 100-year-old books than it is to get 40-year-old books on Amazon, because you can't find or clear the rights for them, and so nobody wants to make them available. And apparently, that's fine with the Authors Guild.
Right. And so, what is it? 40 years? Is that the cutoff as far as where we start running into this gap of works that are old, still in copyright, but not yet in
public domain?
Yes, thank you. Public domain.
You're welcome. No, I just picked that number out of a hat. There's one of the folks who works on the HathiTrust project, John Wilkin, has done analysis with very neat graphs and tables about exactly how many works they've examined from the corpus are orphans by age. And it starts surprisingly early. I think even 20 years, you can find a huge percentage of orphans, because we're not talking about bestsellers here. We're talking about the books in library collections, which sometimes will be small print run academic titles worth preserving, but not things that are mass produced and that people pay as much attention to tracking the rights of. But what Orphan Works legislation would do there, I don't know. The last time there was a draft, it got bogged down by trying to add rules about exactly what would constitute a diligent search for a rights holder before you took advantage of what you could do with a work that you deemed an orphan. So most of the positions among the libraries that I know is that we don't need Orphan Works legislation. We're happy to go with what fair use allows us to do and to work from there.
So folks in IRC are asking for links to the hearing, et cetera, that took place this week. I don't have them in our discussion points yet, but I will put them there after the show. And you, if you check back into delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/250, we'll have some good coverage of what exactly went on in the hearings for you there. Another issue I thought was pretty interesting because it's a different spin on something we discuss a lot on the show, a different context than we're used to seeing it, and that is DMCA takedown notices. Of course, websites receive them all the time. If there's something there that someone claims was purloined or otherwise is an unauthorized infringing use. Of course, video sites receive them all the time. Probably that's what most people think of. But universities receive them too. Can you tell us, Katie, how the DMCA is affecting your ability to use academic articles?
Sure. So what's a pretty common DMCA situation for a university is somebody in gets a notice about copyrighted content that a student has posted, a movie or music or something. What started to happen recently is academic publishers are sending notices for authors, like professors, posting copies of their own articles. Because along the way to getting the articles published, they transferred their copyright to a publisher. And they've, many of them for years, have blithely assumed, but I'm the author, so they wouldn't come after me for posting it. And in fact, at least two publishers now are going and they've hired a company to crawl for their content and send takedown notices.
Wow. So the poor author's out of luck in that situation, aren't they?
Well, yes and no. We explain to them that they have a couple of options. One is to read what they signed, and often what they signed says that you can't post the published PDF, like the one that looks nice and shiny with the formatting and the copy editing. But if you still have your Word version that has basically the same text, you can post that. And so we'll work with folks to post that. Another thing is that I have heard that not all journals are equally diligent with getting authors to sign those publishing agreements. Or sometimes authors will ask the publisher specifically, listen, I know generally your rule is no posting, but how about this one time you let me post this thing? And so if they are in one of those situations where they do have the right to post what they've posted, they can submit a counter notice and we explain to them how that works.
To what extent do you think that professors actually negotiate their arrangements with publishers? Does it ever happen?
It has happened. It's, I think, exceedingly rare. I thought you were going to ask me how often I think they read the things that they sign.
Which is, yeah.
Also a small percentage.
Also answers my question. If you're not reading, you're certainly not negotiating. It seems to me like that would be an issue near and dear to their hearts and probably something that publishers are used to getting requests for now that, you know, we've certainly had the internet. What is it now? 25 years? And people use it as their CV. It's where it's their window to the world. It's especially for someone like a professor who, you know, has to demonstrate their knowledge and scholarship. They need to have a centralized place where they can do that, and they need to have the rights to do it. So it's still just not something that you're seeing them be aware of, Katie.
Oh, definitely rising awareness, especially over the past 5 years, which is why a lot of places like Harvard and MIT and the University of California now have open access policies that the faculty governing bodies adopt to govern themselves. And they create a license in the university that the faculty can take advantage of to post their articles. That license survives the transfer of the copyright to a publisher, unless the publisher requires the author to opt out of it, which some of them do. But it changes the default so that you don't have to wonder exactly what it was you signed. You can just know that as long as you didn't submit a waiver for that article, you can post a version of it.
Right. Open access is something that's definitely on your plate in your role with CDL, isn't it?
Yes. The faculty UC-wide adopted a policy last August, and it's been slowly rolling out and permeating people's consciousness. But again, getting the faculty to read things that are not absolutely crucial to their work is difficult. And so we're just waiting for folks to see the benefits of being able to share their articles more widely so more of their colleagues can find them, so more people in other parts of the world can find them. And we think it'll catch on. But so we're supporting that. And it's going pretty well. And so far, I think we only have one publisher who's systematically requiring authors to opt out.
And which publisher's that?
That would be Nature Publishing Group.
Ah. Okay, so tell us how this works and whether there's been controversy about it, not just from the publishers, but in your university community.
Not yet. There's little pockets of controversy here and there. There are folks among the library and open access crowd that think that we shouldn't take down the articles and we get a notice like that. We should wait and insist that the publisher show us proof of ownership, show us the copyright transfer that you have for this exact article. We didn't want to do that. We went ahead and took them down at least temporarily as we maybe decide to reach out to the publishers later if the faculty want to do that. But whether individual faculty are going to get upset about this or not varies really widely. Some people just say, oh, oops, violated my publishing agreement. My bad. And others really do get up in arms. This is my work. And you're not going to let me post my work because these folks aren't paid for writing these articles. The publisher gets them for free, and the editing, reviewing services are generally volunteer labor of other faculty at other institutions. And then they turn around and sell them back to those institutions. So some folks do get really riled up, which is why we're seeing more and more action in this area as people really get used to and start to assume that stuff like this should be able to be found for free online. And now there's federal policies. The NIH has a policy, and the White House has directed most of the other big federal funding agencies to develop policies. So it's the writing's on the wall.
Right. That was my next question for you is, you know, especially when you're talking about a government funded entity, or at least partially government funded, like the University of California, aren't there other considerations that come into play when you're talking about access to the work product of its employees?
So the University of California copyright policy, like most universities, is that faculty are the copyright owners in the scholarly articles they create. But funding bodies do create mandates, policies that, unlike the UC policies, you cannot opt out of. So the NIH policy, you can't. There's a bill, AB 609, that's been floated for the state of California that would make state agency funded research articles have to be publicly available, and then a lot of other federal agencies are coming online. But as far as the University of California, I mean, that's an ethical, compulsion. Like, you are a servant of the state of California. Share your research. And I certainly talk to grad students who think that's absolutely crucial. They do work on, say, how drought affects farming in the central state, and they cannot share these articles on a website where the folks who are actually doing the farming can read them because their publisher won't let them. And they really have tried to negotiate those agreements.
Yeah. Evan, any thoughts on any of this before we move on?
No. I mean, this is an interesting discussion, and you know, I'm just reminded of a tweet I saw. Sarah Burstein, she's a friend of the show, has been on before. She is an intellectual property professor, and I actually scrolled past it here, but she tweeted on the 2 days ago, I think, something like, you know, she had a really cool publishing opportunity, but couldn't do the deal because of the publisher's terms that they were offering, and then the hashtag was copyright prof problems. So there are academics that are aware of it, especially if you're a copyright professor. You ought to notice yes. these things, I guess.
All right. I want to get into some privacy stories in a minute. But before we go there, there was something kind of making the rounds in social media early on in the week. And when I see sort of my non-tech friends who are parents retweeting something or sharing it on their Facebook page, I know that it's actually, you know, struck a public nerve. And the article I'm talking about is by Chris Rowan, who's a pediatric occupational therapist, not a medical doctor as far as I can tell. But she wrote this piece called 10 Reasons Why Handheld Devices Should Be Banned for Children Under the Age of 12. And she hits on various points such as, you know, delaying brain growth, epidemic obesity, sleep deprivation, mental illness, aggression, various things that she thinks are contributed to by the use of handheld devices at a young age. And her solution is, you know, you just don't give these things to kids. Definitely controversial for parents. I bring it up on the show because it's the kind of thing that I foresee people, you know, writing to their elected representatives about and perhaps wanting to get, you know, the way we keep alcohol and cigarettes away from kids, maybe have some sort of laws around what children are entitled to use on the technology front. My own personal take on the article is that the occupational therapist here has looked at a bunch of data and reached a bunch of conclusions that I don't think are necessarily supported. You know, that yes, you've got some correlated things coming in here, but you can't say that your child's use of his iPod Touch is going to, you know, be a trigger for aggression without a whole lot more information, I think. And the woman herself wrote a book in 2010 purporting that has the words the terrifying truth about devices and kids. And I'm just wondering if book sales were down and she needed to publish an article to sort of get this back on the public radar again. There's a whole lot of other scholarship out there, including a friend of the show, John Palfrey, who has written about digital natives, that take a much more optimistic view on the use of technology by children. So, you know, when people have gotten in touch with me about this, I've kind of pointed them to some of that and said, you know, take a deep breath and make your own mind up, because I think this particular piece is a little alarmist. But Evan, I'm wondering what you think, and if we are headed towards folks lobbying Congress for bans on tech for kids.
Well, first of all, I'm confused. I thought it was my job on the show to be cynical like this and say, oh, look at this author. She's just trying to sell books. And you know, that's why she's... We've been hanging out too long, haven't we?
Yeah, apparently so.
I mean, look, we all want to be good parents, and we want to do what's best for our children, our children's health, and we also care about the contribution we make to the quality of the next generation. So no doubt we're going to be obsessive on the issue, regardless of how we come out on the decisions we make. We're going to be obsessive about the issue of what our good parenting decisions to be made. How do we make those decisions? What's good and right and healthy and all of that for our kids? And, you know, there's some indisputable science, empirical evidence to suggest that too much media, too much screen time, too much use of high technology is bad. But, you know, what thing on the earth taken in extreme isn't bad for you? I mean, you know, you can die from drinking too much water, for crying out loud. So yeah, of course, too much media is going to be bad. And also the absence of, you know, time in nature and fresh air and the development of the brain from interacting with tactile things and, you know, the wonderful time, you know, just things that the outdoor experience and the self-reliance and all that stuff it teaches. So there's some real science here to support that handheld devices and other forms of modern technology and the interfaces that we have can be bad for you. But at the end of the day, at the end of the analysis here, I'm with you, Denise, despite our shared cynicism on all this stuff. We've got to look at this objectively, and like everything else we ever talk about, it's all a matter of balance and integration and recognizing the relative dangers and benefits of these things and not going so extreme as to start lobbying Congress for, I mean, good grief, what do we expect Congress to do to help us with this? The Congress is the last place we should go to be trying to solve a problem like this. When else have they meaningfully, you know, when have they recently, wait, am I being cynical? When have they recently solved a problem for us? I mean, you know, this is a personal self-reliance, family level decision that needs, where decisions need to be made in a family by family basis and then extend out the benefits or the harms to society at large. This is not, gosh, I hope people don't start lobbying Congress for changes on this.
Well, yes. And you know, I think that there is scholarship out there and people, again, crunching the same data and coming up with conclusions sort of exactly the opposite of this, that, you know, using technologies in the way that this particular OT would like to see completely banned for kids between 6 and 12 can be a springboard to greater creativity and higher aspirations in life. It's certainly preparing them for life in ways that a complete technological cutoff would not. Katie, you're out there dealing with younger people, students in the university. What would you think about the notion of having them completely cut off from technology until they're 13 years old?
Yeah, that sounds ridiculous. I had kind of the same reaction as you. I looked, and whenever somebody's writing an article where they claim to be citing studies, but don't actually provide you with enough information to find them, and then you see she's citing her own work four times in one article, I kind of stopped reading.
Yeah. Hmm. All right. Well, it's just something that hit my radar. I thought it would be interesting to bring up on the show, and I will recommend as a counterpoint, and maybe I should put it in our delicious links so folks have access to it. John Palfrey has a great book called Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives, that I think would be a nice offset to this piece. Okay, let's move on and talk some privacy. We can't talk privacy without also talking copyright, of course. This story has both aspects, I think. If you watched Twig this week in Google, you and maybe on some of the other shows too, this is where I saw Leo running around with his narrative camera, the little lapel clip camera that takes thousands of pictures of you during the day. It's a life logging tool. That was a Kickstarter project that is now shipping and people are using it. And the idea is to, you know, keep a record of your day and everyone you've interacted with, everything you've done. And then rather than having you slog through all that really noisy data, it has some algorithms that bubble up to the surface, the best photos, the ones that either have people in them or a lot of color, they're not blurry, things that you might want to keep. So life logging has certainly been around for a long time. I don't know if people remember that Justin TV, which one of the ways that we stream the show, started out with Justin running around with a camera on his head and talking with people and interacting with them and having a ongoing record of everything he was doing. So certainly there are people who, have been pioneering this for a while. There are certainly, benefits to it, but, the privacy aspect is very apparent. People get creeped out, by Google Glass. Of course, they, would be, creeped out by this too, but it seems a little bit more culturally, acceptable to have a little clip down here instead of something that seems to be taking your attention and requiring your input as to the pictures that it's taking. That's kind of counterintuitive, but that's kind of my gloss on that. Evan, what do you think about the privacy ramifications of wearing a little lapel camera all the time?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are privacy implications, and this is a great factual scenario because we can take this conversation in a lot of directions. Of course, the privacy ones, and then the copyright ones, which I hope we can talk about as well. So, I guess one way we could start dissecting or analyzing the privacy issue here is, first of all, dividing the set of privacy issues into two batches. The first one would be the obvious self-inflicted privacy harm that one could occasion from this. You know, for example, criminals do really, really, really stupid things with technologies like Twitter. You know, they tweet about crimes that they've committed, and, you know, those have a real powerful evidentiary value. So, you know, that's just an extreme illustration of the ways that you could disclose a lot of information about yourself. And in so doing, it be contrary to your pecuniary interest, or your penal interest. I didn't really want to say that, but you know that's what they, that's what they against your interest.
We're so juvenile sometimes.
Seriously, I watched. I finally figured it out. One of the reasons that society is degenerating is because people my age are now starting to suffer the consequences of having watched too much Beavis and Butthead in the early 90s. Yeah. So I apologize. So
at least it wasn't on a handheld.
Yeah, let's bring this back up to where this conversation needs to be. I'm sorry, everyone. So there's the self-inflicted privacy harms. And then, of course, there is and this is where I think most of the conversation naturally goes, or the thinking naturally goes on this, to you know, what it means when you are going around photographing everyone else. You know, this is what creeps people out about people who are wearing Google Glass. You know, they're afraid they're surreptitiously being videotaped. You know, oh my gosh, are people taking pictures of me with a funny expression on my face or doing something that I wouldn't want to be photographed doing, even though I'm in public or whatever there. So, you know, I think that there's just going to be this constant conversation about this until technologies like this get normalized, where, you know, there's just an understanding that you can do this stuff and that people actually do it. I mean, if you go back to 1890 and you read that Harvard Law Review article Brandeis and who else was it? You know, it's that famous 1890 Harvard Law Review article that talks about privacy really as a common law, invasion of privacy as a common law tort and dividing it up. You know, some of the factual substrate of what was going on there was, you know, the fact that, oh my gosh, there are actually cameras where you can take pictures of people, you know, you can capture people's images in a permanent medium. You know, I'm just talking about, you know, an ordinary camera, you know, that you know, like that existed in the 19th century. And so, you know, that had its normative resistance from the beginning. The fact that it was just so invasive, this whole concept of having your image captured, even if you knew it and you were out on the street or whatever. So that demonstrates that in the past we can look to where there have been resistance at the beginning, and then there were normative shifts where then nobody thinks anything of it. We probably are just going to see the same thing with something like this. And just as important as any legal developments come around this, there's going to be normative adjustments as well that'll allow and accept this technology to begin to occupy a space in our activities and in the marketplace.
Right. I'm back to my question about how we're going to get permission from everybody, not just on the copyright front, but on the privacy front, to use these kinds of devices. One thing that occurs to me is it's very easy to take something like this into, say, a courtroom where cameras are prohibited. The staff there, you know, there's going to be a window of time at any rate where the staff there won't realize that that thing on your lapel is a camera, and photograph everything that's going on in there. Certainly you wouldn't have permission in that situation. You'd probably be well aware that you were breaking the rules if you went in and did it. But out in public, you know, just to your point, Evan, is it going to be normative? Is it going to be legal? Are we going to have some sort of legal understanding in place that, you know, just as we supposedly do now, you're out in public, you're fair game. I don't think people really internalize that.
I mean, you just got to look at the way people reacted to, it's been a couple weeks now, and I don't have the facts and the actual rationale of the court right at hand, but I just know mm-hmm. that this was in Massachusetts. Did we talk about this on the show? The Massachusetts Supreme Court overturning the conviction of the guy who was taking upskirt photos of gals in public.
I don't think we did.
It all turned on, you know, I mean, this guy was, you know, the evidence strongly suggested, I don't know if he confessed to it or what, but, you know, he was going around and surreptitiously taking photos of women's skirts. And the Supreme Court held as a matter of law that wasn't unlawful because of the way the statute was drafted, and all had to do with the expectation of privacy. So, I mean, the whole point of me bringing that up is that, sure, this is a complex question of what we think of as being private to us. And, you know, if you're out in public, that certainly does change. And it's in those areas where, to the extent our sensibilities will change about what constitutes something that is private, and that we have both a subjective and an objective expectation of privacy, that's going to have to drive legislative activity on this, so that what the law actually is starts to match up with what it is we actually expect. So it's weird things like that, those fundamental expectations, those fundamental notions that we have, to the extent that those are challenged, that's what's going to drive the real shift in all of this.
Katie, you reached an interesting conclusion that I'm not sure I quite buy into, and that's that you put this in our notes as we were prepping for the show, that these photos might not be copyrightable. Explain why.
Because you need a human author to have a copyrighted work. And there's a rule published by the Copyright Office that says that works not originated by a human author aren't eligible for copyright protection. And that includes works produced by mechanical processes or random selection without a contribution by a human author. And this came up, what I thought of when I saw this story was the story from a while back with the monkeys that took the photo.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
Right. And so if it's not copyrightable when a monkey takes the picture, it shouldn't be copyrightable if a machine is automatically taking pictures and then an algorithm sorts through them.
Yeah. Interesting point. What do you think, Evan?
Well, there's a couple layers where we've got to evaluate the copyrightable subject matter, what it is that we're claiming is being having copyright rights attached to it. I mean, first of all, there's the copyright in the photograph itself, the copyright in the individual photographs, and it seems like there would be an easier argument to make that is something that the individual wearing the device would be able to claim copyright in, because, you know, maybe they position it in such a way. This is the second time we can bring up the Cerrone case from 1884, the picture of Oscar Wilde. You know, you may, you know, after a while, subconsciously position yourself, you know, always be having good posture so that you're getting a good view of whatever it is around you, so that the photograph is well taken. I would posit that rises to the level of a contribution to make that work original enough to be protected by copyright. And then there's this other question about the compilation of the selection and arrangement of what photographs are there that the machine goes. I mean, this is curation done by artificial intelligence? And, you know, so this is just a really interesting question that I know that we've been talking about on the show, Denise, for several years. I wrote a paper about this in 2010. It was occasioned by the whole idea of the semantic web, you know, and those technologies mm-hmm. are so always evolving. It's like, well, you know, if you've got smart technologies on the web that are compiling information and creative works emerge from this, is the, you know, who is the author? And then we can start thinking about robots and consciousness and, you know, is it, you know, I think that's the more provocative question, is this compilation copyright, the copyright in the selection and arrangement. And I get the sense when discussions like that become so convoluted and we get so out there that we need some kind of pragmatic approach to this, some kind of Occam's razor to cut right through this and just say, well, maybe it's not going to ultimately matter. I try to channel William James in times like this, you know, what's the pragmatic solution to this? Maybe it's not really going to matter if we can first establish that the individual has the copyright in the photographs, because even if you have a copyright in the selection and arrangement and you're a machine, or you don't have, or there is no copyright protection because of what the Copyright Office has said in interpreting the Copyright Act, it doesn't matter if you can't exploit that right to begin with. So I would love to think I brought this back to some full circle, but I have no illusion that I did.
Well, it seems to me like, okay, so let's move from Ellen's cell phone handed to Bradley Cooper to somebody there having a lapel cam that they turned on the group. You know, that it seems to me that making the copyright analysis different because of the technology leads to kind of an absurd result. That you get the same picture in either instance. It's a valuable picture. People want to assert rights in it one way or another. But because one was taken with a camera and one was taken with an automated lapel cam, you would have different conclusions about what could be done with the photo. Does that seem right, Katie?
I don't think copyright law is afraid of absurd results. it seems weird for sure. Uh-huh. And I think that you would have to, if there was a photo that came out of this process and somebody really wanted to assert their rights over it, a court would have to look at, well, what were you, like Evan talked about, holding yourself in a particular way to frame a particular shot? Or were you, like the article mentioned, just slouched at your desk for 6 hours, not paying attention to anything that you were doing? I don't know. If you're just in the latter situation, it seems more analogous to, you know, a security camera in a gas station that somebody mm-hmm. mounted there. Is what's the copyright status of the video that's capturing on a daily basis?
I guess, I mean, why do we have to, and I'm not, the tone I was using makes it sound like I'm trying to dispute you, and I'm not, I'm just discussing this. You know, why do we have to assume that the creative act actually has to be so proximate to the event of reducing the thing to a tangible medium of expression? Couldn't we look at it as a very systematic, ongoing thing of, you know, the fact that I established this and I was the first mover of this cause to, I was the first cause, I was the first mover, and I caused the series of photos that were taken over the next 3 months to be taken. And that decision in and of itself is the creative, the activity that constitutes or demonstrates the creative spark that ought to entitle me to copyright protection, even to those mundane photos of, you know, my desk here that I took while wearing this thing for 6 hours. I mean, should we be so limited in our thinking that the creative act has to be in the pressing of the button to open the shutter for that one particular shot?
Yeah, that seems reasonable too. I just don't know that that's where it would come down if this went to court. Because I can see it either way.
I'm all for, you know, a strong protection for security cam photos. I think that's just the paragon of human creativity, right?
Right.
Yep. All right. Well, so we continue to push the both copyright and probably right of publicity and privacy fronts with our photographing and video capturing technologies. Let's move on to what's really more of a straight privacy story, although there is a patent gloss to it because as we were discussing on the show, God, was it just last week, the personal audio case, series of cases, this is the patent entity that claims to have the patent to technology covering podcasting. This entity subpoenaed EFF for information, and EFF has been challenging the patent and is involved in these cases, and subpoenaed EFF wanting donor information, wanting the identities of people who had donated to its Save Podcasting campaign, on the pretext that that information was somehow relevant to cases going on. Thankfully, a court has decided that no, that's not going to happen. You can't force a party to disclose who's donating to their litigation efforts. Seems like the right outcome to me. Evan, you agree?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I have to confess the only coverage I've read on this is what the EFF said about it. So, of course, they're going to say it was the right outcome. But, you know, pulling as much objectivity out of it as I can does seem like it was unrelated to the to the litigation going on in Texas, I assume, right? I think I read that somewhere. Is it most mm-hmm. litigation in over the stuff in Texas? You know, what EFF had done in connection with the activity in the patent office, and given the whole purpose of that process in the patent office, it ought to seem like those things fundamentally should be separated, and that's all separate and apart from whatever privacy interests you can have. I did not go and actually read any of the briefs in this, but it sounds a lot like some of the associational interest cases that go all the way back well into the 20th century about the right to be anonymous in as much as you are associated with a group of people. This is a First Amendment issue. You know, there's that whole concept of free association. There's free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of association. You know, there's several different things that are packed into the First Amendment there. I know there was a well-known Supreme Court case, I think it was from the 50s, involving the NAACP, where the identity of members of the NAACP was held to be protectable as anonymous. They could be anonymous because of this First Amendment right of free association. So it seems to comport with general notions that this isn't something that your opponent in a dispute somewhere else in a different part of the country and under a different set of rules, it seems to comport pretty well that ought not to happen, that this discovery ought not to be had.
Katie, this seems like something that must come up in the library context a lot. Certainly, it's a sort of a prototype case of, you know, you having First Amendment interests in what you are reading and up to at a library. Is this an issue that's close to your heart?
Not mine personally. I stick in copyright, but I do know mm-hmm. a lot of librarians who do follow it closely. And mm-hmm. Any library is going to protect patron records like that. You're not going to get folks sharing what people have checked out. When I was in library school, I remember reading a lot of coverage about the Patriot Act provisions for the government requesting library records. And when they did that, the library was not allowed to say anything about it to anybody. And the libraries did not like that at all.
Yeah. All right. Well, Edward Snowden made some interesting remarks at South by Southwest, appeared on a panel there. Just wondered if either of you had some thoughts. His general message seems to be that it's up to the technologists to really put security in place that's going to make this kind of surveillance, if not impossible, then harder to do. Do you agree with that premise, Evan?
Well, yeah, and we should expect that coming from Ed Snowden. Too bad the audio was so bad on that thing at South by Southwest. You know, it's kind of a letdown. I think there would have been more attention after the fact that, you know, there weren't any good sound bites for the mainstream media to use in Ed mm-hmm. Snowden's appearance because of the Skype issues that we all know too well about. But yeah, I mean, it makes sense, the things he was saying. You know, more encryption end to end. That's a technical thing. I mean, the whole theme is, you know, new ways of using tech, or not new ways, but, you know, new emphasis, new priorities in the ways that we use technology. So more end-to-end encryption, Then there's this really intractable problem of the idea of, what it translates into at one level is, you know, is the user of a platform the customer, or is the user the product? And that's this idea of the data collection and the economic importance of that, the financial reasons that platforms collect so much information about people in the first place. He encouraged platforms to not collect any more information about people, users, than is needed, and to not retain that data for any longer. But you can see that there are cross purposes here, or the interests aren't aligned here. If there's the interest in the individual with privacy, that having not as much information gathered about you and it not being retained for as long is not nearly as effective for the advertisers and the platforms that provide the space for the advertisements on there. So what we got to in a real provocative sort of closure on this discussion, and this was extracted from the piece by Chris, you pronounce his name, Sahoygian, something like that, the ACLU guy who was involved with the festivities with Snowden, was rethinking mm-hmm. our relationships with tech companies. And really it gets so extreme as to say, you know, maybe we ought to consider shifting our thinking about this so much to, heaven forbid, hang on everybody, here it comes, pay to use some of these services. Like, oh my gosh, pay to use Facebook, pay to use Twitter. I know I'm speaking blasphemy and, you know, it's just so incomprehensible, but that would be one way of putting, you know, aligning the interests a little bit better. Because the more we expect free stuff, the more we ought to expect to turn over information about ourselves and thereby put ourselves at jeopardy of being, swept up into mass government surveillance. So I guess we got to pay for our civil liberties at some point.
Yeah, that would certainly be a step. I agree, Evan, in aligning the interests. But even in a for pay kind of situation, you know, that's not going to stop the government both from listening and subpoenaing information. I see what you're saying, that there would be certainly an enhanced interest in protecting the customers in that situation. Right. Katie, we've been saying all along through the show that there's copyright in everything. Do you think that there's a copyright angle to these national security kinds of concerns? I always find it interesting when people assert copyright when their interest is really privacy, and in the is anyone up kind of context, for example, that what they want is to get the information out of people's sites and off their attention, and what they're using as their sword is their copyright interest in the photo or the video. You think there's an opportunity to fight surveillance with copyright?
I doubt it, based on what we all agree to in terms of service when we join mm-hmm. up with Facebook and Twitter at all. We pretty much give it all away. We don't have a lot of power, as Evan says, as the product and not the customer.
Yeah. Again, maybe Evan, if there were a different economic arrangement in place, maybe that would be the kind of thing that would change. We mentioned the web is 25. Tim Berners-Lee wants us to have a Magna Carta. Katie, you think that's a good idea?
Sure. I don't know where it'll come from or who will enforce it.
But exactly, just some sort of position paper that is aspirational is the best we could hope for.
Well, I think most folks say they see this whole environment is so huge, and the big players are the big players, and they deal with what there is, and they don't see a way of advocating for change that's effective.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Evan?
Well, I mean, there could be ways of making something more substantive than just, you know, oh, here's an abstract Magna Carta. I mean, we've got things like the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is really, I'm no scholar on this point or an expert or know anything more than just what I know from being on the internet about this. I don't think something like that has the effect of law, but it certainly has the effect of influencing the way that policy decisions are made and perhaps influencing the way international treaties are negotiated and entered into and what the critical points of negotiation are in those things. So, you know, that more than just being aspirational, I suppose the way that, you know, if we're moving into a more global economy and a globally governed system, at least in as much as governments ought to cooperate with one another, there may be ways to make that actually meaningful, something to actually implement and influence the way regulation and law and policy goes.
All right. Well, as she often does, Sue the writer in IRC has suggested our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, and that's penal interests. Penal with an A. Thank you very much. And I'm sorry, Katie, did I cut you off? Were you going to respond there for a sec?
Oh, I just was going to say, as far as international progress there, this is where I decide to be cynical and say, based on how international discussions to handle copyright have gone, I don't have a lot of optimism there. But I'll try to scrape some up, because that would be great.
All right.
I imagine we're all equally cynical. I mean, I was still being abstract in the suggestion that the avenue was possible. Yeah, all you got to do is look at the TPP and, you know, other... I've lost track of all the different things we've talked about over the years where there's international agreement. What's that stuff that was going on in Dubai earlier this year about, you know, the just large scale questions about internet governance are often woefully disappointing when they actually occur. Those discussions.
Right. Well, it seems like Tim Berners-Lee is throwing his hat in that ring, or at least taking the occasion of his prestige and the anniversary of the web to voice some opinions. He says we do need to revisit a lot of legal structure, copyright law, the laws that put people in jail, which have been largely set up to protect the movie producers. So he's a fan of copyright reform and keeping that issue on people's front burners. Let's move on to our tip and resource of the week. Our tip, again, I caught this by watching Twig this week in Google. I don't think I've yet had these Google Docs add-ons appear in my account, although I'm looking forward to them. They're looking like cool additions to Google Docs. One of them is through an entity called HelloSign. And I bring it up. They mentioned it on Twig, too. It's an easy way to, if you're using Google Docs, you can incorporate an e-signature add-on in your document. So if you're doing a contract and you want to send it off and you don't want to have to go through the contortions that people still do these days of, you know, signing a fax copy and then sending that ink signature by mail so that you have originals. There actually is an e-sign act that has been in effect in the United States for, gosh, I don't know how long, but it is sort of more honored in the ignoring than in the use. But it is a way to do legally binding signatures, and HelloSign is one way to do it. There's another entity called EchoSign that I'll point you toward. If you haven't heard of them, they were acquired by Adobe. I use them a lot. And just a really much more streamlined way to get things signed. I'm not aware of any litigation of one of these applications being used and having the contract struck as invalid. That's not to say it couldn't happen. Evan, are you using e-signatures in your practice pretty routinely these days?
You know, not really. You know, and at the risk of making it sound like I'm some sort of Luddite or not wanting to embrace progress, it's, you know, that's certainly not it. It's just that I have often, I mean, and sure, there are circumstances when e-signatures are good. If it's a international transaction and or you know, just the particular sensibilities of the situation warrant it, and, you know, certainly do that. But, you know, for 90%+ of the transactions, there's nothing wrong with printing, signing, scanning and returning by email and people keeping copies of agreements that way. So again, I hate to sound like I'm sort of out of it or not, you know, not willing to embrace the way things are going here. But, you know, this is not, I haven't seen any sort of revolution by any stretch of the imagination since the eSign Act was implemented or, you know, in the way that law is actually practiced and contracts are actually entered between parties.
I know it's so funny to me that that's the case because it is legal to electronically sign things. And still, I don't know, you know, when the last time you did a mortgage or a refinance or anything that requires those stacks of documents that they use in real estate. But they sure haven't heard of e-signatures in that arena. So I encourage folks who listen to the show to use them and give us all a break. And it doesn't have to be on legal documents, too. I mean, you can always feel good anytime you are needing a signature. I would think, you know, things like school permission slips and stuff could be streamlined by use of this Google Doc add-on. And our resource of the week is something that Katie spotted. This is really cool. It's at openculture.com, and they have 15,000 plus free Golden Age comics from the Digital Comic Museum. You want to tell us a little bit more about this, Katie?
Well, I heard about it from a librarian. Yes, they have all these comics that they scan or they'll scan comics for people, or people will upload their own scans. And their cutoff is 1959, and they've got some crazy stuff in there, and it's all public domain. So you're not going to find DC and Marvel and that stuff, but a lot of the smaller publishers and weird government propaganda and good times like that.
Looks really cool. Thanks for highlighting that. And so if you're interested in public domain comics, really neat resource of that over at openculture.com. So I think that's going to do it for this episode of This Week in Law. It's been such a pleasure chatting with you, getting to know you a little bit better, Katie. Anything else that you've been working on that you want to highlight for us that you think would be interesting to our viewers and listeners?
I'll just stick in one last minute plug for libraries generally. Your library is doing all kinds of crazy stuff you might not be knowing about. They might have a 3D printer and a makerspace. There's a library pack now, every library, that's funding elections across the country. There's guerrilla story times. There's crazy stuff going on at libraries, academic and public. So go take a look.
Where have you seen a library with a 3D printer?
I haven't been to one, but I feel like that's all some of the librarians I know talk about. So I'm do a search. They're out there.
That's really cool. Yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, when I was young, you would go to the library because they would have cool technologies that you might not like have at home, like a copy machine, for example, and make use of it. So sure, why not a 3D printer? That's a great idea. What is Guerrilla Storytime?
It is less structured, less planned. People do this at conferences to exchange ideas and like different techniques in an unorganized kind of grassroots way.
Very cool. All right. Well, I just can't tell you how great it's been to have you on the show. Really a pleasure talking with you. And we really appreciate all the great work you do on behalf of the University of California Library System. I was a student there way, way back in the day. And I'm sure the kinds of things that people have access to today would just blow me away. I should head on over to UCI or UCLA and just spend a day in the library and marvel at how different it was from when I was in school.
Definitely. Thanks.
Evan, great to chat with you again as well. How are things going in Chicago?
Things are going great. You know, just, keep staying at work in the salt mines here and, just really looking forward to spring and all the things, coming up there. I've got a couple of new speaking engagements coming up. I'm going to be talking about in April at John Marshall Law School about ethics. I mean, I don't hold myself out as an ethics expert, but talking about some of the ethics of intellectual property trolling you know, copyright trolling. And then, of course, you know, it's a sort of a different flavor, but there are similarities with patent trolling. So I'm going to be compiling some new knowledge for that. So I'm looking forward to getting ready for that. So that's kind of the new thing on my radar screen. Otherwise, just, you know, day by day, trying to do good work for my clients and help people make better decisions. So it's all good.
Super cool. And I can't believe we've made it through this entire episode without any sort of banana slug references, Katie. That is entirely my fault. I've been remiss.
Sorry.
That's because Katie, for a while, a long time actually, worked at UC Santa Cruz, and their mascot is the banana slug. Do you have a lot of banana slug wear that you sport around? Or
not a lot. I am a fan of the t-shirt that says "No Known Predators." Which is a lie. The banana slug has plenty of predators, but it makes for a nice shirt.
That's right. I love the Santa Cruz area. It is so gorgeous there. You're a lucky gal that you get to hang out there and commune with the slugs. They're nice little critters, gooey and squishy and neon yellow often. So with that, we will go ahead and wrap this episode of This Week in Law. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. If you've been watching us live, you've been doing so at, we started at 11 o'clock on Friday here. That's when we always record the show live, 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. Please join us then. It's always fun to have a live audience, and jump into IRC if you are doing that at irc.twit.tv. But if you can't do it, don't worry about it. You can always watch the show on your own time by heading over to twit.tv/twill. Our whole archive is there. Also on YouTube, youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. We're in iTunes, on Roku, however you like to get this kind of entertainment. We are there. You can probably get it on... what's it called again? Popcorn Time. I don't know. I haven't checked that out yet, but you know, be sure and sign that disclaimer when you start using it. What else should we tell you? We should tell you to get in touch with us between the shows. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. We love getting mail from you or hearing from you on Twitter. He's Internet Cases over there. I'm D Howell. And we have a Facebook page over for This Week in Law. That's what it's called. It's facebook.com/thisweekinlaw. Also on Google+, there's both a page and a community there where we love to see your suggested links of things we should talk about, pay attention to, love the guest suggestions, feedback on things that we've already discussed, further information about things we've already discussed. All of it is good. Please keep it coming. We couldn't do the show without all of your input, and we're really, really appreciative of all the folks that support the show. So thanks so much, and we will see you next week on This Week in Law.